from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Listeners, this afternoon I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Susan joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. She's here today on Tuesday. Yes, it is Tuesday because yesterday was the 4th of July, Independence Day, a holiday. I welcome your questions for Susan. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and she's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, as well as the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find Susan on the web at www.eatandmove.com. That's EATNMOVE.com. Questions about diet, nutrition, and exercise? They're invited this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Did you have a good holiday weekend?
Yes, it was a nice one.
Yeah, beautiful weather. A little warm yesterday.
Right.
Boy, Saturday and Sunday were lovely.
They were lovely and enjoyed the parade. It was a nice long parade, and so it was fun to be out.
Yeah. Well, what do you want to talk about here to get started before we take some telephone calls?
Okay. I have a couple things. One that I just think is a good example of why it gets so confusing with food and nutrition. I was reading some of the emails that I get. I'm on several different email lists on food and nutrition research that's come out. And one of the emails I was reading just today was talking about how the FDA has not approved green tea as a food component that is cancer preventative, although there have been some studies out. And I was thinking about how confusing that is for all of us, because that just came out, and then here I have a piece that was in the June 2005 issue of Alternative Medicine, which covers a lot of nutrition, with big headlines saying, "It's official, green tea fights cancer." So I guess the bottom line when you look at a lot of these things nutrition-wise really is we have a long way to go. I think we still have a long way to go in terms of saying that a specific food for sure is going to do a specific thing in the body, but we do know that it kind of gets back to eating more antioxidants does appear to be helpful. Whether that's going to necessarily prevent breast cancer or a certain type of cancer is still questionable, perhaps, when you look at all the research. But, it does get back to that eating more fruits and veggies like we talk about and getting more of these natural antioxidants is still helpful. And I think sometimes people will read those comments or read the reviews that come out now that are negative and say, well, forget it, I'm not going to eat that anymore. And I think the important thing to recognize is that we're still learning a lot. There's still a lot of new things coming out. And sticking with the basic things we do know about more natural food components, more fruits and veggies in particular, and things like that, certainly is helpful. We don't know how helpful in terms of exactly preventing a certain thing, but we do know in terms of decreasing our risk and trying to stay healthy, it's important. But I always get a lot of calls about things like that when you see new messages coming out or new headlines coming out that contradict something that has just been out there, and it is confusing for us. But the main thing that I thought about was just how important it is to kind of stick to the basics, like we've talked about so many times on the show.
Yeah, I guess there's, you know, there's no magic bullet.
Right.
And you've always said, you know, just eat a wide variety of foods and enjoy yourself, right?
Right, right. And enjoy eating, too. Yeah. So now, so we'll keep an eye on that one.
Yeah. Now, so what is the, what's the story now on green tea?
Well, from the bulk of the research that I've read, and I've done some projects, I'm working on one right now with the U of I, where we're looking at particular foods and how they might be helpful for cancer prevention, particularly with people maybe who've had cancer and then what to eat. You know, that's the big question. If you've gone through cancer treatment, now what do I do to make sure that I'm trying to prevent having future problems with cancer? And there's still a lot of studies when you look at tea that show that that is just high in certain antioxidants that may be helpful. And so, again, probably using tea as just a part of your daily living. Maybe you like tea, so you have 2 or 3 cups of tea a day. Some studies showed you had to have 10 cups of tea a day for actual prevention of cancer. So we might want to be more reasonable and say, well, you know, that might have been one study. The FDA looked at that study actually in the review I read and said, well, it's not a real strong study. So even though it might say it's preventive with breast cancer, it may not be as strong as a few of them that say it doesn't really help from what we've seen. So I think what you want to look at is say, well, if it's something you like, it certainly is a healthy option, particularly maybe healthier than just drinking water because you're getting something else in it, some nutritive value. And so continuing to use that as a reasonable way to say, hey, maybe this in combination, because I think that's the bottom line. We know that people who tend to eat more vegetarian-like diet, even if you're not vegetarian, but you are eating whole grains and fruits and veggies, you are choosing better sources of fats, more mm-hmm. nuts and oils and avocados and seeds and things versus saturated fat, tend to have lower risk of disease overall, tend to live longer, tend to often be lower body weight. So I think looking at the big picture, that reminds us of how important it is to kind of stay the course, even if you see these studies that come out and say, gosh, you know, does broccoli do all this? Does it not? What about berries? Is it really going to help me prevent from getting Alzheimer's and these kinds of things, that probably there's a lot of things working together, real synergy with food. And we're seeing even more studies with that, looking at synergy and different things to do together that might be most beneficial. And so that's where I think it's really interesting, is how do these food combinations work? And a lot of these things we've been doing for years.
Yeah. Now, maybe you'd share with us a little advice when it comes now to deciphering labels that say healthy or right. may help prevent fill in the blank.
Exactly. I think, and that gets confusing too, because now on labels we can see more things that might look more even like supplement labels. Now we can see those a little bit more on food labels with the changes in the food labels. I think that the most important thing to keep in mind is that, again, you can't expect to take one food and think that that's just going to do it. You know, you eat a really high-fat diet, but you eat these stanol and sterol margarines or the cholesterol-lowering margarines and think, well, that's just going to do it because I'm taking that. It's kind of like someone who might go on Lipitor but not take a look at their diet at all. Yeah, we know that Lipitor is probably going to bring down your blood cholesterol levels, but we know if you're eating all these fatty foods all the time, you're still going to be at higher risk. And so I think it's the same thing when you look at food labels. Something might be lower in sodium. That's great. You need to think of what else I'm doing with it if you've got high blood pressure. And so those foods can be a real addition, but not to rely on them solely for, you know, the main benefit that you're getting, but you really need to look at what you're doing on a consistent basis. And I've had a lot of clients lately who have really been so worried about their diets, it seems to me, maybe because of summertime and we get more worried about our weight and how we look and those kinds of things. But, you know, I really seem to be talking a lot lately about how important it is to just consistently get your body what it needs. You might have a day where you don't eat well at all. That's really not going to hurt our bodies in the long run if generally we're eating pretty well. And I think often, particularly women, I think we get to feeling maybe guilty about what we're eating. And so we have a day that's not so good. So it's easier to have another day because we feel like we're off the diet and so on. And that can roll into months and months at a time. And so important thing to remember is that what your body's going to look at, what you get over months at a time, not one day at a time. So right. you have one day at a time where you had a quarter custard cup or something, I suppose that's not really going to hurt you in the long run. So you really need to think, hey, or the holidays, and you might have eaten a little different, or you've been on vacation and kind of getting back to eating more normally.
Let's take a call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Is there anything new out on soy? I heard a British study on the BBC that claimed that they didn't recommend soy products for women who want to be fertile, and that it, believe it or not, it makes sperm mature too quickly in the body. And instead of men not eating soy, it was women that weren't supposed to eat soy. But what about soy for postmenopausal women?
Well, soy,
especially in a vegetarian diet. Sorry.
No, right. You know, it's really important questions to ask, and I think soy is another area where, again, incorporating soy in the diet the way that it has been for so long in Asian cultures, particularly in most of those studies, if you really look at them in terms of amounts, they end up being maybe one serving of soy a day or maybe even up to two servings, and a serving being, you know, let's say a half a cup of soybeans or 3 ounces of tofu or something like that. You know, we don't tend to see big problems or problems in general with that kind of use of soy. And in general, again, we look at using more soy foods in more of their natural form, you know, using tofu or tempeh or miso or soybeans themselves,
right.
Edamame, those kinds of things. And so when you look at those studies, there seems to be a lot of benefit from soy, and we don't generally see a lot of problems from soy. But it appears that when we do get into using more of the soy proteins or more large amounts, maybe even trying to get three or four servings a day to try to get that 25 grams of soy protein, maybe to help with cholesterol lowering, that tends to be larger amounts. And so in those amounts, again, in the long term, we don't know as much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that more processed the soy is, then there may be higher risks associated with that if you take in large amounts. So I think the bottom line, you know, when you look at soy is if you look at the preventative benefits of soy or what we think might be most beneficial for, let's say, women in breast cancer, we certainly do find that early intake of soy in adolescent years tends to be the most highly associated with lower risk of breast cancer. So postmenopausally, what often we'll see or what the research says is, again, if you use it maybe a serving a day, it may have benefit, but certainly it's not going to necessarily be therapeutic, but probably not going to be harmful at all. But if you're trying to use it more for the actual benefit, probably having it earlier in life is the time you may get the most benefit from it.
Well, I think it's beneficial in a vegetarian diet because it's one of the highest substances that's not meat or animal-based that has protein in it. Not that that's the only substance that I use. I mean, also other types of beans, for example, or nuts and seeds and, you know, things of that nature. I also eat dairy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just thinking of it in terms of a vegetarian diet.
Right. I would go, I mean, my recommendation, people, is use the 1 to 2 servings a day that we've seen people consume for long time and in a lot of different cultures. And that, even with 1 to 2 servings, you can certainly get 15, 20 grams of protein as well as a lot of other things. So it can be a real hefty addition to your protein intake as a vegetarian. At the same time, it's not, you're not relying solely on that. You're using other kinds of beans. And like you mentioned, that's a big key. A lot of times people have gone directly towards soy and use the soybean, but kind of forgotten about black beans or red beans or lentils as much and things like that. And so I always encourage a combination of beans.
Right. It adds variety.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Anywhere else, if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, you mentioned that quart of ice cream a couple minutes ago. Well, when it gets really hot, that's really nice to have a little ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, when it comes to advising people, do your, in terms of meal plans and that kind of thing, does your advice change a little bit in the summertime if you're trying to help somebody get out of the kitchen, so to speak, or prepare foods that are not hot and heavy?
Right, right. Well, I think you want to look at what's naturally available. And of course, if you look at the summer, whether it's farmers markets or even what's available in the store, you just see so many more fruits and veggies and a lot of different types of them. And so one thing to look at is where you might base your meal on, let's say, your main dish being pasta and sauce and things like that. Well, you might still use pasta, but instead you're cutting up maybe 3 or 4 cups of fresh veggies to throw into pasta salad So you're eating the same amount of food, but actually you're probably eating a lot fewer calories because you're getting in a lot more veggies in there too. And so that's one thing I really encourage people with is making sure that again, you're taking advantage of the different fruits, making fruit salad, making smoothies, juicing, things like that might be a lot easier to do in the summer. And the summertime, again, is a lot of time people might be more active naturally. So I think it's a natural part of the year. You know, we'll have parts maybe when we're not as active, parts when times when we are more active. And it's certainly a natural time of year you can get in better shape because you're generally going to be walking more. You're going to be out more, hopefully, if it's not too hot. And so that's also another time you can usually grab more fruits and veggies. And I think a simple thing, I think we always have to remember that we tend to eat things that we can see. And so putting fruits out in front of you, in particular in a bowl, not just in the refrigerator. I don't know how many times people will say to me, well, I buy all these things, but I never eat them. You know, they sound good, they look good at the store, and then a week later I realize they're rotted in the refrigerator. So having things out in plain sight, coming home and chopping up carrots and taking the ends off onions and putting them in bags so you can grab them easily, and making things single portion size. I mean, even when we were watching the fireworks last night and I'd cut up some apples and throw them in a bag and brought those. So, you know, we might have been the only people munching apples there. I don't know. But, you know, that was one thing we had. So at least you could mix that with other things because it was easy to grab.
Yeah.
So I'm such a firm believer in we will eat what's simple and easy and something we can grab and hand food. And so making more things like hand food is really easy in the summer. And it makes a lot, you know, lower calorie generally, too, and higher nutrient.
So prep them and bring them to the table.
Right.
Or put them in your backpack or your handbag or whatever.
Right, right.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question. I have a son who is a distance runner. And more frequently after he's really exerted himself, like in a race, in competition, he will get headaches like several hours after he runs, and occasionally just like in the summer now when he's training, he goes out for, you know, long, slow, you know, 6-8 mile kind of runs, and he will occasionally complain of headaches. Now, he is real good about hydration and he's generally a pretty good eater. Do you have a guess as to whether this is tied to nutrition, whether he's maybe just not getting enough calories, because he does start to lose weight when he trains hard?
Well, one thing we look at, certainly it could be related to nutrition. It could be related to other things as well. But, you know, one thing we want to look at is sometimes people will have this, particularly runners, sometimes will have this kind of later after a workout, more of a rebound kind of low blood sugar. And that may or may not be what's happening to him. But what I always look at if somebody gets headaches or feels real low energy after their training, after their workouts, is we try to make sure that an hour before they have a decent snack and maybe 2 hours before something else with a little bit more protein. So, for instance, for him, maybe 2 hours before he runs, he has peanut butter sandwich and a piece of fruit. And maybe an hour before he runs, at least he has even something like a cheese stick and crackers, if he can handle that, if it's not too much on his stomach.
See, normally he doesn't. He'll eat about 2, sometimes even 3 hours. But maybe you're just saying some small snack an hour before might help?
It might help, because maybe with him, especially if he's going 6 or 8 miles or so, that maybe he's used up a lot of his energy stores, especially if he's lean. You know, the more muscle weight mass we have, the more glycogen or muscle carbohydrate we can store. And
quite lean, yeah.
If he's quite lean, then he just may not have that much on board. And so he may look at doing that, or even an hour before drinking something like a Carnation Instant Breakfast Shake or something like that that's liquid, that he may find that, it doesn't bother his stomach at all, but it gives him some more energy before. And then the other thing I would certainly do if he's not doing now is, you know, rehydrate as soon as he gets done running, but also try to get some calories in there right after.
Okay.
So in other words, at that point, that's a good time to have a smoothie or even a yogurt with fruit or something that's easy on the stomach, but get some energy in rather quickly.
Okay.
Just in case it has something to do with maybe his energy stores are just a little bit low. And it also may be that a lot of times people will drink, but they still will be dehydrated later in the day because they've just lost so much fluid. And so the thing is, drink right after, keep drinking on an hourly basis. Try to drink a good 8 or 16 ounces after a run to make sure that it's not related to that in terms of rehydration too.
Yeah. He's usually pretty good with that. When you say get some calories in right after, what kind of a window are you talking in terms of time?
Well, when we look at muscle glycogen or muscle energy stores being replenished, particularly for endurance athletes or for runners or cyclists or so, then we try to get that in within 15 or 30 minutes.
Okay.
Now, that can be really variable depending upon what somebody can handle. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, even juice as opposed to water is better because it's quick carbohydrate, can get back into the system. Again, if blood sugar has been a little bit low, it certainly can help get some energy in there quickly.
Okay.
But then you might want to think, yeah, I'm going to have that, and then I'm going to try to at least eat something small, even a bowl of cereal, you know, something to get in there that would be helpful. That window is important because within that time, you've still got blood flow to the muscle, so you can get energy back in the muscle faster. And we find that just athletes who are trying to stair-step train and keep training a little bit harder each time, it tends to really help after endurance workouts because it kind of trains your muscle to store a little bit more energy each time, in which case the next run you could go out and maybe have a little bit more available as long as you're eating well overall.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bye.
Next we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello. I'm in my first trimester of pregnancy, and I've been following the Brewer's pregnancy diet, which basically focuses on high protein intake and a general balanced diet, and it's supposed to be really good for decreasing the risk of toxemia and eclampsia. And one of the things that's included in that is that you're supposed to salt things to taste and not to avoid salt. But other things that I've read say that pregnant women should watch their salt intake. I guess I'm just not clear on the discrepancy and why one would say make sure you're getting enough salt and the other would say make sure to keep your salt intake down.
Well, there are different ideas with that. I mean, generally we think if you're active, if you're eating well, if you're not gaining too much, you know, weight compared to your norms and what your goals are with that, that if you use a little bit of salt, generally most people are going to be okay. Now, if you're predisposed to preeclampsia or having trouble with water retention or anything like that that is already a problem, then we definitely would say really monitor your salt because that could certainly make it worse. But if you're not retaining fluid, if you're gaining weight normally, then probably if you use some salt, again, that salt-to-taste idea, not use a lot, but maybe use a little bit, it's probably going to be fine. And so that's kind of the idea. We always say watch your salt intake in general because there are going to be a lot of women who tend to retain fluid and might tend to have more problems with toxemia and things like that. So if you are at high risk for that or if you know you're retaining fluids, then that's when we definitely say, well, really watch your salt intake because that could make it worse. But as general purposes, general healthy diet, you need some sodium in your diet. You don't need a lot, but just basic salting of food, like that says, is for somebody who's not having a problem, generally that's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. You can join us with a telephone call this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan generally joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. She's here today on a Tuesday because yesterday was a holiday, and we wanted to bring her in and not let a whole month go by before she was back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. No one waiting at the moment. The question of salt and sodium, what does it mean when you see a label that says low sodium?
Low sodium generally has to be 140 milligrams per serving or fewer, and when you look at milligrams of actual sodium. And so that's pretty low. If you typically, you know, if you, let's say, have a frozen dinner or some type of frozen item or a canned soup or something, it's probably going to be 5, 6, 7, 800 milligrams at least, sometimes more. And so 140 milligrams is pretty low if you look for that. And so that's a pretty good truth in labeling item to look at if you need to watch your sodium intake. If it says low sodium or if it says very low sodium, it's going to be about 40 milligrams or 35 milligrams or lower. So then it's going to be extremely low. So that can be really beneficial if you're trying to watch that, to look at those. And again, sometimes with sodium, if you think about using salt, and the caller asked about salting foods lightly. Well, certainly if you have a shake on there, it's not very much. I mean, there's about 2,400 milligrams of sodium in a teaspoon of salt. And so you'd have to salt a lot to get a lot. So you can see where processed food, that's quite a bit compared to maybe if you make it fresh and you just add a shake on there or salt to taste and it's not very salty. you can get a lot of good flavor on that, which would probably be a lot less than the processed food as far as what that would have.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm on cholesterol medicine right now, and I've been talking to people about different situations they're in, and I've heard people talk about low carbohydrate diets and their effect on cholesterol. And I wasn't sure if you could talk a little bit about that. That seemed a little bit more unusual to me. It's a fact that somebody said they went on a low-carb diet, and it brought their cholesterol down way low. And I wasn't sure if that was related to, I'm a little bit familiar with heart zone conditioning and its effect on, you know, burning fats versus other things, basically. Anyway, I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, there certainly have been many people, I think, who, and certainly clients of mine, who've gone on some of the higher protein, very low carb diets, and generally along with weight loss, they may see drops in lipids. Not everybody, but
right.
For some people, they see drops in lipids. And what we think is that for the most part goes along with body fat loss or body weight loss as well. And so no matter what kind of diet you're on, for most people, you're going to see a drop in lipids, unless one of your concerns, let's say, is triglycerides, which can be affected by carbohydrate. And so sometimes with people on very, very high carbohydrate diets or even moderate diets, they can't seem to get their triglycerides down without dropping their sugars or dropping their carbohydrate a little bit in the diet. And so for patients or people who have high triglycerides, we do often recommend maybe a little bit higher protein, a little bit lower carbohydrate, because that may help with triglycerides. But with overall lipids, let's say with total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol or bad cholesterol,
mm-hmm.
we certainly see generally drops in lipids for most people when they lose weight. We certainly see drops in lipids when they cut down on their saturated fat intake, and often when you increase fiber. And so, you know, for instance, you might be familiar with kind of at the very end of that plan is the Dean Ornish plan, or the very, you know, 10% fat, pretty much vegetarian diet. And certainly most people on that plan see dramatic drops in lipids,
okay.
as well as people who might be on, you know, find that they do lose a lot of weight on a low-carb diet. Because they lose that weight, they may also see some drops in lipids too. And so I think if you're looking to do the thing that maybe would help the diet or help your blood lipids in the long term, mm-hmm. what we know is we have more long-term studies on lower saturated fat diets, high-fiber diets, diets that would not be low-carb. They'd be moderate carb. But then the carbohydrate you eat is pretty good, you know, are pretty good choices. You're eating whole
yeah.
grains, fruits, and veggies, and you're cutting down on saturated fat, and you're adding good fats like avocados and nuts and seeds and things like that, because there certainly have a lot of studies now that show that, you know, adding nuts to the diet, if that's replacing saturated fat, that in many people that will drop lipids too.
Mm-hmm. Is it worth then putting, trying to concentrate on, you've kind of touched on that, but really focus on the quality of the carbohydrates if you're doing that, rather than worry about doing a really, really low-carb diet, for example? I mean, that's what I've been wondering is,
right.
they talked about a good balanced diet, but it wasn't necessarily the quality of the carbs that was discussed. And
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think you still want to, especially if you're exercising, you want a moderate carbohydrate diet. I would not, for most people, I don't recommend going down below 50% carbohydrate, because
right.
you need to get those whole grains, you need to get fruits and veggies. And a caller before had mentioned beans and the benefit of beans, even soybeans and just beans in general, because of all that fiber.
Right.
And we know that can help with binding some of the cholesterol and bringing that down as well. So, but with all that comes carbohydrate.
Right.
And that's a good thing. That's not necessarily bad. So if you cut your sugars down, but you're bumping up the quality of carbohydrate, and I just have never seen any long-term data to say that on a very low-carb diet where you're getting a lot of high saturated fat meats, which a lot of the diets do promote,
right.
a lot of high fat, that in the long term is going to keep lipids down or keep you healthy. So I'm from the studies that I see and from what we have a years of research, that's not something I'd be comfortable recommending. But I do know that you want to make sure that, yeah, the quality of carbohydrates, that's key. Because I think for a long time we never thought that much about it.
Yeah, right. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Next we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask your guest to pursue the line of discussion she had taken up in response to a caller whose son was a runner. I do a lot of biking. I can't schedule it very regularly. I don't really know exactly what I should do about eating before or after. And if you've got some general principles that I can try and put into practice, I'd be interested in hearing about them. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
From the research we do have with, for instance, how much energy or particularly how much carbohydrate, because that's primarily what you're going to burn when you're on the bike, you need to take in when you're exercising. We have some studies that back the idea of about 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour when you're exercising for endurance. So that would be if you're running, if you're cycling, if you're swimming, if you're doing some type of endurance longer exercise. Let's say you go out on the bike for 3 or 4 hours. That might be a good place to start, at least 30 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Now, if you look at that, that might be something as simple as the first hour you have a granola bar and water, the second hour you're maybe having some Fig Newtons, the next hour. The whole idea is that you're consistently getting that in. And for some people, that 30 grams at lower end is nowhere near enough. And I certainly have had a lot of cyclists who need more than 60 too. But I think the main thing you want to think about is when you go out on the bike, have you eaten something within the last hour or two? So you have something in your system. Have you pre-hydrated? And usually by that we say, well, of course, try to drink as much as you can all day, but then an hour before, try to shoot for another maybe 16, 24 ounces within that hour before you work out or the hour before you leave. So you're pre-hydrated, time to go to the bathroom before you get on the bike. And then when you think about fluids, again, you probably want about 6 ounces or so every 15 or 20 minutes. And so, you know, if you look at taking a sport drink, that's helpful for a lot of people. But if you're on the bike very long, that's not enough. You're going to need something solid to eat too. So, again, maybe taking even some trail mix or certainly energy bars or granola bars or things like that that are quick and easy to open that you can eat on the bike. What I recommend is, again, trying to get in that first – make sure you start with the first hour. In other words, don't go 2 hours and then think, oh, I'm starving now. I'm never going to make it back. Yeah. That's what we tend to do. Instead, think, yeah, within that first hour, I'm going to maybe drink some water and a sport drink, and I'm going to have some trail mix. And then the next hour, I'm going to have my granola bar or energy bar, and I'm going to have sport drink or water. And so by the third hour, fourth hour, you've been getting energy in every hour, so you feel like you're in pretty good shape.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. A caller on cell phone line 3. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a 7-month-old, and I'm trying to do my best in terms of introducing things in an age-appropriate manner, and I'm making all of her own food, and she's doing really well. She's super healthy. Seems to like a lot of different fruits and vegetables, which is definitely the goal. But I've kind of run into some confusing information regarding when to introduce yogurt. And I was wondering if you could help me. I've been using as kind of a reference book, a book called Super Baby Food that had some really good, you know, recipes and hints about how to make your own baby food. And the author suggests that it's pretty much okay to introduce whole milk baby yogurt as early as 6 months. But then I've also kind of had some conflicting information from our pediatrician, and I, you know, want to do the right thing for my daughter. So I was just wondering if you could kind of give me some insight.
Is she on breast milk or formula? How much is she taking now?
Sure. She was exclusively breastfed for her first 9 weeks, and then we went to a combination until about 3 months. And since then, she's been just on formula. And we do 2 solid meals a day right now, and she is taking in, approximately 24 ounces of formula a day.
Well, the whole idea about yogurt, and this is tricky. I have a 3-year-old, and I went through the same thing, how soon to introduce yogurt, because it's good, because it has particularly some of the baby yogurts that have the natural bacteria, and those are all good.
The acidophilus.
Right. The idea is, you know, we find that there may be some problem with milk allergy if you introduce it too early, and of course, it's a whole milk product, so it's milk.
Right.
It's cow's milk, and so, you know, our best, at least in my opinion, the best information we have says, well, wait towards maybe 12 months for milk, for whole milk products. And that's why we generally say keep a baby on formula or breast milk for the first year.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But this has just been something that has been on my mind for a long time. Is the milk protein found in formula, is it just that chemically different from the milk protein found in other, you know, in other whole milk dairy products? Have they just altered it that much that, you know, that infants are that much more tolerant of it that you don't see? I mean, obviously, I know you see some allergies to formula, but it's really like apples and oranges by the time they've changed that protein.
Well, when you look at it chemically, the differences, particularly in the peptides or the proteins, they make the formula as close to breast milk as possible. Because
right,
that's,
right.
of course, so it is different than cow's milk and different than whole milk. And so, you know, I guess as a big picture, what I see the trend is trying to get babies eating more like adults as soon as possible. And I don't know that that's necessarily healthy. I think it's fine that you're, you know, what you're doing with introducing the foods gradually, and particularly the fruits and veggies and things
like. Well, we didn't start until 5 months.
Which is great.
I'm completely with you. I think that a lot of parents introduce solids way too early.
Mm-hmm.
And we waited until she was basically crawling on our laps and into our plates. She was so interested.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which is good. I think, if I remember correctly, I think just personally that I started – yogurt is definitely what I started first in terms of milk. And my daughter was still nursing, but I think I started yogurt maybe 10, 11 months. And that was personally what I did because I was more concerned with trying to prevent the milk allergy and making sure that I was as close to that 12 months as possible. But it was something she never had any trouble with either, you know, taking that in. I think it's another good source of protein. And again, it adds good bacteria. So if your baby's growing normally, if there's no problem and she's eating really well and at this stage, I wouldn't rush it personally.
Okay. At what age would you suggest introducing a third meal?
I think if she's hungry and she's eating well and everything, I don't think there's any problem with having that relatively soon if she's digesting fine. And again, they're within the foods that we recommend starting. And that book you mentioned is a great one. I use the same, you know, I have the same book and it was real good. And I don't think there's any problem with introducing a third meal as long as she can handle that fine and seems hungry and, you know, she'll tell you.
Sure. And she's, I think that as a new mother, that's been like the biggest thing for me is really learning to rely on her for cues that she's ready or not ready for things.
Exactly.
When you introduced the third meal, did you introduce meat at that point? I was a pretty much strict vegetarian up until the time that I was pregnant, and then kind of like had some cravings for meat and was fine with that. I really want her to be able to eat a wide range of things before she starts making those kinds of lifestyle choices for herself. But I'm not really crazy about introducing meat at this point, but yet I know that, you know, three meals of cereal a day can be kind of a heavy load, you know, on the kidneys. And so I guess that's the other thing that I've been kind of confused about from what I've read and from talking to our pediatrician is what exactly that third meal should look like.
Well, I think every child is different with what they can handle and do, but again, I didn't feel, and I don't see that there's any rush to start with meats. Again, as long as she's getting formula and she's getting a lot of her protein, she's getting some other supplementation there, which is great. And then you're getting the fruits and veggies and some of the cereal and the grains that can be tolerated in. I don't see any problem with a baby not getting meats early on like that.
Okay.
So I think, and the thing you want to look at is just the total diet, you know, everything that she's getting. And one thing you might want to look at, we've mentioned this in the past, but you may want to just, you know, and you're probably already doing this, but write down everything she's getting periodically. And so we can take a look at the balance and then compare those servings to what's recommended in the book, because that's a good book. And there are other good ones out there, too. But that can be helpful as kind of a reinforcement, you know. And I think the other thing to recognize is that for centuries, a lot of babies had breast milk for the first year, basically, almost exclusively. And because there's so much in there and there's so much in formula, too. And so that you're probably doing a great job, you know, with how you're doing everything.
So if we were to do a third meal and to just do like a fruit or a vegetable, that would be okay as long as we're kind of taking into account, you know, the big picture and everything that, you know,
she's. Okay. Sure.
Okay. And just to put in a kind of shameless plug for making your own food, I am like, you would never pick me out of a crowd as that kind of a person. I love it. I think it is so incredibly easy, and it's one of the greatest gifts that I can give her.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea until I started it how easy it would be, as well as being economical.
So right.
I recommend that all new parents at least kind of explore that road before, you know, they go the way of actually purchasing food, because I was just stunned once I started doing it how much time it saved me, as well as how much money and how great it is for her. So.
Yeah, that's a great comment. I remember having lots of green and orange filled ice cube trays in my freezer during that time because you make everything and you can freeze it in little to pop out one ice cube tray of green beans or whatever you have. So I think it's great. I think if you can do that, it's super.
Let's talk with another listener now. Caller in Loda on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have diverticulitis. My doctor said no hard seeds, and I asked him about tomatoes. He said, no, that's fine. But what are hard seeds? I mean, is it like blueberries or strawberries? Or I know he told me no peanuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, this area of diverticulitis is kind of controversial. You know, there are certainly some docs who feel like you should be avoiding all the, any kind of seed, let's say sesame seed or, again, strawberries or any of the little, anything that could be very small and kind of get caught in one of the diverticuli. And then there are others, and the general kind of diet we look at is to watch these things if they bother you. But certainly there's some idea there, and there's some research to back the fact that if you don't have a flare-up, generally you can eat whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hear different recommendations from different docs, too, and I can't say that we know for sure. I think it's very individual. But the thing that I would, generally take a look at are certainly any things like nuts or, again, any other larger seeds generally are fine, like pumpkin seeds or something like that. Or, again, maybe tomato seeds won't bother you. But these smaller ones, poppy seeds, for instance, or something like that, that might be on a roll or that kind of thing. If there is some inflammation, sometimes those can get stuck or they can cause some inflammation and cause it to be worse. And so I always tell people, if you know that something's bothered you in the past, stay away from it because it may be something that really does affect you. And then as far as these other things, if you don't mind not having them anyway, maybe better off not having them because they could potentially cause a problem, although they don't in everyone. So I would kind of keep that in mind. If you know that something's bothered you in the past, and of course we don't always know what it's been, keep in mind with that. And then to be on the safe side, I would try to stay away probably from nuts or these little seeds or anything that you might eat that could get into small, hard pieces. That's another thing to keep in mind. I mean, sometimes we'll eat things that just don't digest very well, and that can be a problem. Sometimes people have problems with fatty meats because the fat doesn't digest very well, and so there are other things that could potentially be a problem as well. But the thing you want to keep in mind is just generally a pretty high-fiber diet and lots of food or fluid to try to get things, working your gut and try to get things moving through on a consistent basis. The longer something sits in there, the easier it is to maybe get wedged in, the gut and cause some more problem.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Sticky fiber would be a good thing.
Yeah.
Like oatmeal, right?
Right.
Okay.
And oat bran and also wheat bran, because that's another thing that can add a lot of bulk that can move things through.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champagne, line two. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, I have a question about fiber. A cereal box like shredded wheat and bran, it says dietary fiber 8, but 1 gram is soluble and 7 grams insoluble. And I wonder what the difference was and which was the better kind.
That's a good question, because we'll see, often you'll just see total dietary fiber, but now we may see soluble and insoluble. The insoluble fiber, for instance, on this shredded wheat and bran that was 7 grams, or most of what you had, that insoluble fiber, is more the fiber that will add bulk to the stool but not necessarily be digested. In other words, generally a wheat bran, if we think of whole wheat bread or a lot of the cereals that are primarily wheat, shredded wheat, that's going to actually take in fluid in the system and add bulk to your stool. And so that type of fiber is really helpful for constipation and keeping regular, helping prevent constipation. The soluble fiber that Celeste mentioned, that might be more found in things like oatmeal or barley or gummy type of fiber, beans. That's the type of fiber that doesn't necessarily move things through as fast, but what it does do is may help decrease blood cholesterol levels, may help manage blood sugars, because it's this gummy fiber that takes longer to digest too and is very beneficial. And so let's say if your main goal for fiber is to decrease cholesterol, then you may want to go for more oats and barley and a variety of fruits and veggies. But if your main concern is mainly to just keep regular, then you'd probably want to go for more wheat bran and whole wheat type fibers are more insoluble. Fruits and veggies are generally going to have both. So if you eat a lot of fruits and veggies, you're going to get both soluble and insoluble.
Okay, very good. We've got to wrap it up. I have a question for you before we go, but you'll have to be brief.
Okay.
Multigrain pastas, seeing a lot of advertising on that, and I was wondering if you had done any experimentation, if you had used any of these products, and how do they work in, you know, like with a spaghetti sauce, or how do they work in a pasta salad?
Right. A lot more of those out, and the biggest difference I find is that they just tend to be chewier, and they tend to be actually more filling because they've got more fiber in there too. And so you may, depending upon the directions on the package, you may need to cook them longer because they may require longer boiling time. But it's a great way to just add fiber naturally. If you're going to eat those foods anyway, you might as well choose a whole grain version or at least mix half and half with whole grain.
Oh, okay. Very good. Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. She's here on a Tuesday because yesterday was Independence Day. So she will be back with us on the first Monday in August. How about that? Susan Kundrat. You'll find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. That's EATNMOVE.com. It's 1:52, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. It's Dave Dickey with us this afternoon. Hi,
oh,
Dave.
No, it's
no.
not. No. You know, you just, I'm gone on Mondays a lot.
I thought.
Just because we have lots of days off. No, I'm here all week this
week. All right.
All week.
Well, it was a wild day today, wasn't it?
It was a wild ride at the Chicago Board of Trade, Celeste. And futures were on the wild ride to the upside. So that should make farmers across the Midwest, at least if they're in the right side of the marketplace, on a happy space for the day. Of course, for every winner, there is always a loser. And there'll be some fairly heavy losers today at the Chicago Board of Trade in the bean pit, where futures were up 40 and three quarters cents in the Septembers. The Novembers were up 42 cents. Most of those will be both new crop months, September not officially, but a lot of times as we run low at the end of the year on what's in the pantry, that September reflects more what's happening in the new crop than it does in the old crop. From the Board of Trade, futures in the soft red winter wheat pit finished like this for the day. July futures 341, the high, the low at 329.5, a settlement price at $3.37. They were up 12 and three quarters for the day. September's at 351.5 on the high, the low at 337. September wheat at 346.5, up 12 cents. In December futures, 365, the high, the low at 351. Settlement price at $3.60.5, up 12 and a quarter. And the March contract at 375.5, high, the low at 362. Settlement price there at $3.72. They were up 12 and a quarter for the day. In the corn pit, this is where the action really took place, I believe, for a good portion of the day, on the idea that over the next couple of weeks, as tasseling and silking and, fertilization takes place across a good portion of the corn crop, and certainly here in the state of Illinois and parts of Indiana where it's been very dry, the dry weather conditions that are called for may have a serious impact on how many kernels are put on. And the corn finally coming out of the gate has been avoiding this for 6 or 7 months, watching the soybeans climb and then fall back. But today, corn futures up 14.5 cents in the July contract, 235 the high, the low at $2.22, settlement price at $2.31. Once again, that July contract up 14.5 cents. September futures $2.44, the high, the low at $2.30.25. Settlement price at $2.40, up 14.5. The corn, by the way, dragging the wheat higher as well today. December futures, this is finally your new crop, up 15.25 for the day. $2.51, the settlement price, the high at $2.55, the low at $2.41. March futures $2.63, the high, the low at $2.49, settlement price at $2.57.75. They were up 14. And the May contract, $2.63.5, the high, the low at $2.52.5, a settlement price there at $2.61. They were up 13.5. In July contract, $2.65.75 high, low at $2.55.5, a settlement at $2.64. They were up 12.75 for the day. July oats, 8.5 cents higher, $1.68.5. The high and the settlement price, the low at 161.75. September futures, 174, the high, the low at 166, $1.73.5, the settlement price for the SEP oats. They were up 9.5 cents for the day. From the soy complex, nearby beans, 38.75 cents higher for the day, with a settlement price at $7.12.25. Their high at $7.23 and the low for the July soybeans at $6.89. August contract a $7.26 high, low at $6.92, settled at $7.15.5. They were up 39.5 cents. In September futures, $7.28.5 high, low at $6.96, settled $7.19.25, up 40.75 cents for the day. November futures up 42 today, $7.36 the high, the low at $7.02. Settlement price off of that high by 8 cents at $7.28 for the day, up 42 on the day in the November beans. January futures, $7.39.5 the high, the low at $7.05, settled $7.29.5. They were up 40 in the March contract, up 42.5 today, with a high of 23, a low at $6.95, and a settlement price at $7.19. Bean meal futures up $11.30 today, $226.50 the high, the low at $214.50, and settled at $220.80. They were up 11.30. Bean meal August contract 227.80. The high, the low at 215. Settlement price at 221.50. They were up $11 even. July bean oil up $1.15. 25.42. The high, the low at 24.60. Settled 25.30. And the August oil 25.50. High, low at 24.70. Settlement price at 25.39. And they were up 1.16 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Higher day today on the Merc. August feeder cattle 110.90. The high 110.25. The low, the settlement 110.72.5. That up 42.5. September 110.35. The high, the low 109.70. Finishing at 110.25. That up 40. October feeders 108.65. The high 107.95. The low, the settlement 108.62.5. That up 52.5. August live cattle 80.80, the high 79.40, the low, the settlement 80.15, that up 82.5. October 83.80, the high, the low 82.80, the settlement 83.55, that up 70. July lean hog 68.30, the high 67 even, the low, the settlement 68 even, that up 170. August 67.75, the high 66.30, the low, the settlement 67.35, that up 130. October lean hogs 59.60, the high 58.15, the low, the settlement 59.10, that up 105. December 56.50, the high 55.50, the low, the settlement 55.92.5, that up 32.5. July bellies 59.75, the high, the low 58.40, the settlement 59.50, that up 157.5. The Dow is up 67 points at 10,370, the NASDAQ up 20 at 2077, the S&P 500 10 higher at 1204.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.